It was a drippy May day like this one when Charles Lindbergh took off for France and history, the first solo airplane flight across the Atlantic Ocean. It's been 90 years, almost to the day. And the occasion is marked with a new book about Lindbergh's feat, with an emphasis on what it was like to sit in the cramped cockpit of the Spirit of St. Louis, handling the controls and worrying about hazards and sleep. Dan Hampton is the author of The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's daring and immortal 1927 transatlantic crossing. Dan Hampton is a retired Air Force colonel and decorated fighter pilot himself. He's written three previous nonfiction books, a novel, and all kinds of articles, including classified works for the Air Force. Colonel Hampton, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. And Dan is just fine.
Okay, great. As you mentioned early on, Lindbergh is a figure of controversy, some controversy in later years. I mean, any reluctance about picking him as a subject for a book?
No, absolutely not. In fact, one of the reasons I wanted to research him was to see how much of that was true and how much of it wasn't.
Oh, really? And so did you find a bit of an overstatement of some of the things he said in later years?
Yeah, as you're very well aware, since you deal with public opinion, sometimes it gets carried off in the wrong direction, and that's what happened to him. A lot of what he was blamed for was overstated, and in one case, there wasn't anything he could do to correct it because it was a secret.
Oh. All right, so let's talk about what he actually did in the cockpit of a plane. You're a pilot. How impressive is Lindbergh's feat to you?
That scares the hell out of me, to tell you the truth. I flew that route many, many times, but I was in a jet fighter with all kinds of cool stuff aboard, and you know, I could talk to anybody in the world, and there were other airplanes out there with me. The fact that he did it in the Spirit of St. Louis at 100 miles an hour for 3,000 miles, most of it at night over the Atlantic with no way of knowing where he was really going, is frightening.
Well, you know, and I didn't realize until, I'm glad you include some pictures in the book too, but the cockpit of the Spirit of St. Louis has no forward-facing port. There's no windshield, really.
Yeah, and that's not really that big of a deal. Most folks who don't fly, that's appalling because they think, well, how could I drive a car if I couldn't see straight ahead?
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, you really only need to look forward like that in flight. When you're coming into land or when you're taking off, you generally look out the side in those kinds of planes because, you know, they will tilt back as you come into land. You can't really see much anyway. But, you know, it still would have been nice to have, and he had to look through a little periscope that was installed. And in his own words, you know, he didn't think he really needed it because there was nothing to see but ocean for much of the flight. And he was right, but still kind of disconcerting.
Yeah, it's kind of weird looking at that bank of instruments and this wall with this funny-looking periscope and the little tiny mirror that reflects what it's pulling in here. Lindbergh,
yeah,
as you point out, didn't just do this for fame and glory. He did it for money, too. Tell us about the Ortega Prize.
Yeah, he didn't, you know, and the fame and glory thing is interesting because I think that's one reason why the public adored him so much initially, was because he was not out for Charles Lindbergh. He was not doing it for the fame. In fact, I don't think the fame really even occurred to him. He was very private and didn't go in for that sort of thing. So I think that caught him by surprise. The money, you know, $25,000 in 1927 is about $340,000 now, so it's not insignificant, but, you know, is it worth your life? He was really doing it to prove that it could be done. It was a challenge to be met, and he wanted to prove that, A, he could do it because everybody told him that he couldn't, and, B, that commercial aviation had potential. You know, there could be a day when the continents, even the world, could be linked by commercial flights, as it is today. He foresaw all of that.
So even with all the use of aircraft in World War I, and the Ortega Prize just came a year after World War I, I mean, were people still not thinking of fixed-wing aircraft as a real commercially viable kind of thing for moving people in cargo?
Well, they were getting that way, but it was still very much in its infancy, at least in the United States. America did what America usually does. You know, we get all spun up over something and advance really well and do really, really good things, and then the war's over and we think, hey, that's the last war we'll ever have to fight. You know, well, let's put everything in mothballs and everyone else can go on to what they're doing. And aviation lagged considerably in America compared to Europe. Europe had some commercial air routes, lighted beacons, you know, some things that we didn't really have here, and Lindbergh desperately wanted to prove that, hey, not only can it work, but it needs to, because this country's so big, you know, it makes sense to link it by air.
Yeah, I mean, the railroads weren't that crazy about that, but we could talk about that a different time. So the Ortega Prize was offered up in 1919 and then had actually come close to expiring once and then was renewed because it was supposed to be within 5 years. So over the 8 years then, since it had put out there, how many people had tried to win it from your count, Dan?
Well, it did actually expire in 1924, and he renewed it. And there weren't really any serious attempts until the latter part of the 20s. The Atlantic, a lot of people don't realize this, had already been crossed by air several times. In fact, back in 1919, the U.S. Navy did it with some flying boats, but it was not nonstop. They flew from Newfoundland to the Azores to Portugal and then up to England, and only one out of the three made it. Not very practical for commercial purposes, but it had been done. And then a couple of British pilots had done it also in 1919. They flew from St. John's to Ireland. But this was not New York to Paris. The New York to Paris was symbolic. For Raymond Ortega, because he was born in France, he was, a hotelier in New York, but he was born in France, and he wanted to link, as he saw it, the two greatest capitals in the world, and he wanted to prove that it could be done without stopping. That was the big draw to the Ortega Prize.
Which Charles Lindbergh did indeed do on a flight that began on May 20th, 1927, almost exactly 90 years ago. Dan Hampton writes about it in his new book, The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's Daring and Immortal 1927 Transatlantic Crossing. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So over the 8 years the Ortega Prize was out there, how many people had tried to win it, and what kind of fate did they meet with?
Well, the latter part was the more impressive part, and a French ace named René Fonck had made a serious attempt back in September of 1926, also taking off from Roosevelt Field, and he crashed on takeoff. And I point out all these attempts were made by big airplanes with multiple engines and a crew of at least, three people. Some of them had four. So he tried it. A couple of American Navy pilots, Davis and Wooster, less than a month before Lindbergh went, they took off on a test flight from Norfolk, heading up to New York, and they crashed and died. And then not even 2 weeks before Lindbergh did it, two Frenchmen took off from Paris, Nungesser and Coley. They were both great war French Air Service pilots. Highly experienced, very, glamorous. Nungesser had married an American socialite. Everybody loved him. He'd made a couple of movies. They took off from Paris coming to New York, and nobody ever saw him again. So there were some serious attempts. There were two other guys waiting at Roosevelt Field, Curtis Field, on Long Island, to go, which is one reason why Lindbergh kind of rushed into it. Richard Byrd, who'd gone to the pole, was one of them, and Chamberlain was another one, and they both had, very well-equipped airplanes. They were both much more well-known than Lindbergh was, and they were just overcoming some technical difficulties and some legal problems before they went, and that's one reason why Lindbergh jumped at it when he did. He didn't sleep for at least a day prior to taking off, and when the weather broke, it kind of caught them all by surprise, and he just made the decision to go. He said, "Let's go." Because if we don't, these other guys will beat us to it, and that's what he did.
So give us an idea of the strategy, though, about how to go, because you mentioned a lot of these guys went with crews of multiple people aboard, so there could be a chance to rest, and there were larger planes. So how was it Lindbergh decided solo and with this particular plane, the Spirit of St. Louis?
Well, now that's something I can particularly identify with because I was a single-seat, single-engine fighter pilot, and that's what he was. He was single-seat, single-engine, and he reasoned that, hey, multiple engines just means you have multiple pieces of things that can go wrong, and if one engine fails, can the plane really fly on the remaining engine or engines? Probably not. And having a crew, that just means you depend on people. He had the attitude that hey, if it's just me, it's just me, and I've got to do it all myself, and I only depend on myself. And that's what he did. So he had worked out, he'd planned the trip very well. He'd worked it out, worked it out on Mercator projection charts. He knew the course, he knew the fuel, he knew it was going to be a challenge to stay awake, which is why when he designed the airplane, he made it purposely hard to fly So, you know, you couldn't set an autopilot and doze off. He had to continuously fly it with his hands and feet. He left the windows off. He had two side windows that he could put in if he wanted to, but he left them out so that it would be cold inside, and maybe that would help keep him awake, too. So, you know, he had a lot of challenges, and he overcame them.
Wow. So, I mean, just in terms of accoutrements and panel displays and things like that, how does the cockpit of the Spirit compare to anything you flew? I use the term accoutrements loosely.
Yeah, you know, I've been in it in a couple of flyable replicas, so I can attest to its Spartan conditions and its difficulty in flying. You know, it was very basic. You know, he didn't even have a fuel gauge because they weren't very reliable. You know, he didn't carry a radio because what's the point? You know, they're heavy, they're bulky, they didn't work very well. Who would he talk to anyway? You know, he carried the bare minimum in survival equipment in case he crashed somewhere, but it wasn't very much. He only carried a canteen of water to drink and five sandwiches that he bought at a deli on the way back to the airfield from New York. You know, he didn't carry much, you know, and that's one benefit of being, you know, 25 years old and full of confidence. You know, you think you don't need much, and he didn't, you know.
As it turns out, sure. Can you imagine, though, Dan, as you look at that cockpit and as you have sat in the replicas, spending 30 hours in one of those?
No, the longest I ever spent in the cockpit of an F-16 was about 15 hours, and that was miserable, absolutely freaking miserable. And I, you know, I think about him doing it for twice as long at 100 miles an hour, you know, and it's that truly makes it a truly impressive physical feat for him to be able to do that.
You mentioned no autopilot, no big surprise there, but was there not even anything that he could use to lock anything in position? No clamps to hold the stick in place, anything like that?
Not the stick. He could lock the elevator, the, you know, back on the tail, the the flat horizontal part that moves up and down. He could lock those. But that's not going to keep the plane. It's not an autopilot. All that does is prevent him from having to use, you know, trying to switch hands, you know, to continually manipulate that. Once he got to a altitude that he wanted, at a speed he wanted, he could lock that into place. But, you know, the ailerons and the engine and the course and all that stuff, he had to monitor and do physically himself.
Dan Hampton, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about Charles Lindbergh's flight that commenced on May 20th, 90 years ago, is called The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's Daring and Immortal 1927 Transatlantic Crossing. You point out that Lindbergh had not flown over water much before. What skills are needed there?
He hadn't flown over water at all. His first time really over water was when he crossed Long Island Sound between the Long Island's coast and the Connecticut coast. Which isn't very far. It's about 30 miles.
No, it's visible.
And he was impressed that, you know, he had flown across it because that's the most water he'd ever been over. And then he remarked to himself several times as the day went on, you know, when the stretches of water became greater, how easy it all seemed now.
Uh-huh.
Flying over water can be tricky. Not so much in the Atlantic. The Pacific's worse because of the shadows from the clouds. The Atlantic really isn't like that most of the time. But the winds can be a bit tricky. He ran into ice, which he sort of expected because he was flying a little bit farther north than most people did. But he'd never seen it before. He didn't know what it was at first. You know, so that can play tricks with you. If you had to come down on it, would definitely be a problem. And he thought about that. He had a lot of conversations with himself, which I incorporated into the book as much as I could. You know, he gained experience very quickly, but then that's kind of the point of gaining experience, right?
Right. Yeah, I guess so. That's a real crash course, if you pardon the expression.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about things like, I mean, if you get in a hazy set of conditions, and more than that, I mean, at night, how would Lindbergh know where he was? It wasn't like there were lots of aircraft beacons on points of land, and there weren't points of land for hundreds of miles.
No, there wasn't anything. You know, he's in this tiny cockpit. He has a compass. He has a magnetic compass, and he has a new invention called an earth inductor compass. So he figures, you know, between those two, he can more or less hold the course that he's plotted. One of the problems with that, though, is he had to read the magnetic compass backwards through a mirror, because the only place they could mount it in the cockpit was kind of over his head. So there was a tiny hand mirror that a girl gave him in Long Island before he took off that he stuck onto the instrument panel in front of him. So, you know, at night he's reading this wobbly compass backwards in a mirror, trying to fly in straight and level and keep his heading. Very, very difficult. Again, no autopilot, no fuel gauge. He was able to maintain level flight. He had an accelerometer, which is sort of like a primitive attitude indicator. And you can usually tell by your airspeed indicator whether you're, you know, going up or down, because you get faster when you go down. So between all of these things, he could do it, and he did it, but it was, you know, very primitive and not the way I would want to do it.
So he was not likely to see anything really between Newfoundland and Ireland flying at night, right?
He picked up some ice at night, because you can see that if the weather's right, but then he ran into a 1,000-mile storm. And a storm in an airplane is never much fun. A storm in an airplane when you're over the dark ocean at night by yourself is even worse. And again, he had no idea of knowing how big it was, how fierce it was, how long it would last. He just kind of had to suck it up and survive it. And that's what he did. And all through that night, you know, he kind of weaved through the thunderstorms. He could see, you know, cloud shapes through the lightning sometimes. when he got to the edge of the storm and got above it, you know, he could see the moon. And I can tell you that that's a wonderful experience when you finally can see something other than the clouds, you know.
Yeah.
You break out of the clouds, and because it's like flying in a cotton ball, you know, and all of a sudden you can see something else, and that's great. He could see the moon. You know, he was ecstatic the next day when he saw his shadow, shadow of the airplane on the waves, because it was something else to look at. Then he saw some dolphins, you know, and it was something else living, you know, something else alive. And after all those hours of being alone, I know how he felt.
So, Dan Hamden, if you know all this, Lindbergh must have left some great notes and diaries about his trip and lots of other parts of his life, too, I assume.
Yeah, you know, I was greatly aided not only by the fact that I'd seen it and done it to some degree myself, but the fact that he took very good notes. His flight log from that flight was stolen in Paris, so we didn't have that, but he reconstructed a lot of it. When he got back, one of the first things they did was rush a book called We into production, and it was a horrible book. He thought so, too. very, very basic, you know, not very detailed. And he didn't purposely go into a lot of details about flying because he didn't want to scare people, you know. He wanted to promote aviation. He didn't want to discourage them. So he left a lot of those details out, and I had to get into his private papers and recollections, you know, from later in life to reconstruct a lot of that.
When you look at how the course was chosen, how the path was picked, all that stuff, I mean, did it seem like there were some pretty good things done here? I mean, flying east at a time of the year when there's not much nighttime light anyway, because you're getting close to the solstice. I mean, were these things that he had done to make sure he didn't fly in darkness much, or was it just lucky?
No, well, some of it. I mean, he was driven by... The timing wasn't really by choice, because he knew he had to do it soon or somebody else would do it. Chamberlain or Byrd would have done it. So the time he really couldn't do much about. The route he gave a lot of thought to, and that's why, you know, he flew as far north as he did. He figured that the less time that he was flying, the less time that he was over water, was less time that something could go wrong. So it's called great circle navigation, and, you know, if you picture a volleyball or a basketball or something, obviously the sphere is wider across the, you know, the middle. If you go over one of the tops, or, you know, over the top or around the bottom, it's a shorter distance. That's a great circle. And so he knew that he was flying well beyond the shipping lanes. He knew that the weather would be worse up there, but it was the shortest route from New York to Paris, so that's why he chose it.
So I have to believe that there were moments when he did wink off a little bit. I mean, did he write much about that in his personal papers?
Later, I mean, the ones that weren't initially published, he wrote about it quite a bit. He didn't write about it in the spirit of St. Louis because, again, he didn't want to scare anybody. But, yeah, he dozed off a few times. And actually, you know, usually movies aren't quite accurate, but Jimmy Stewart's portrayal of his flight in the spirit of St. Louis was actually very well done, because Jimmy Stewart was a pilot, too.
Yeah.
And he actually looked a little bit like Lindbergh, and Lindbergh did doze off. And it is easy, believe it or not, even when you're flying the plane for long distances without changing much, you know, it is easy to kind of zone off. Think about it in a car, you know, you get on a long straight highway,
oh,
it's
sure.
kind of easy to zone off a little bit. Well, it's the same in an airplane, and it happened to him.
So what, I mean, you mentioned that it was great to have something to see when he could see the moon at night and when he could see the shadow of the Spirit on the waves during the day. But what was it like for him to see first boats and then finally land off in the distance?
Oh, he was ecstatic to see the boats. He, you know, open water can really play tricks on your eyes, and he had believed he had found land in at least one time. And it was nothing more than shadows on the waves, which sounds a little hard to understand to folks who don't fly, but it really can happen. And so when he saw those boats the first time, I mean, he knew they were boats. These were men. This wasn't a dolphin. Dolphin was good, but this was better. These were men. These were people, you know, and there's an instant, you know, form of relief when you realize, hey, if something really bad happened right now, at least there's men here to get me. But then he got confused because he thought, these are pretty small boats. What are they doing out here in the middle of the North Atlantic? See, he got pushed. He had a 100-mile-an-hour tailwind all through the night, and there's no way that he would know that. So he's 3 hours ahead of schedule.
Oh, wow.
So when he sees these boats, he thinks, what are these boats doing out here in the middle of the ocean? And then when he picked up Ireland, he thought, where in the hell am I? I'm nowhere near land. Did I go off course during the night? I mean, where am I? Because I should be 300 miles, you know, farther out to sea than I am. And it really, really confused him until he figured it out.
Which he did indeed, and he landed safely at Le Bourget Field near Paris. Charles Lindbergh took off from Roosevelt Field on Long Island on May 20th of 1927, almost exactly 90 years ago. The occasion is marked by Dan Hampton's book, The Flight, Charles Lindbergh's Daring and Immortal 1927 Transatlantic Crossing. Dan, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.